This is WSHU's After All Things with daily news and culture from around Long Island Sound. Our region is part of a $17 billion settlement with Meta over child safety. Fairfield is sticking with speed cameras despite pushback from residents. Plus, our region is defined by our waters, and no one captured that love of life by the shore better than Rachel Carson. Those stories and more are coming up. I'm Sabrina Garon. Connecticut and New York are part of the $17 billion multi-state settlement with Meta that calls for child safety reforms on Facebook and Instagram. WSHU's Ebong Udama has more.
Tammy Rodriguez is an Enfield, Connecticut mother who lost her 11-year-old daughter, Selena, to suicide in 2021 due to an Instagram social media addiction.
I have become a big advocate who is very much into educating anyone in the life of a child of these harms because they're hidden and people need to know what's really going on.
Attorney General William Tong says that's why Connecticut joined the lawsuit. He claims Meta knowingly designed Facebook and Instagram with addictive features that exposed young users to serious mental health harms and intentionally misled the public.
Meta has essentially surrendered at trial. They know it's going poorly. They know we have them dead to rights. And that's why Meta is going to pay the states $17.1 billion over 10 years.
Connecticut will receive about $256 million, while New York will get at least $819 million. The money would be used to support mental health and crisis intervention. Ebong Udama, WSHU News.
Fairfield town leaders say they're sticking with speed cameras even after hours of testimony from dozens of angry residents at a town meeting this week. WSHU's Davis Donovan reports.
Fairfield has put up speed cameras in six school zones across the town. Fairfield's police chief says they protect children and get drivers to slow down. But resident Hillary Long said they're unnecessary.
I think if we want the cars to go slower, we can just put speed bumps in. It seems as though this is a money grab to just tax and surveil the citizens of Fairfield. And I don't think anyone voted on it. And I think it should be something that everyone should vote on.
Ultimately, representatives voted by about a 2-to-1 margin to keep the cameras. They also voted to create a committee to oversee and potentially change ordinances around the cameras. Davis Donovan, WSHU News.
Two people central to the 2023 Bridgeport ballot stuffing scandal rejected plea deals yesterday. WSHU's Molly Ingram has more.
City Councilman Alfredo Castillo and former Democratic Party Vice Chair Wanda Jeter-Pataki both declined deals from state prosecutors, meaning a jury will decide their fate. The two Democrats were central to the case that resulted in a do-over mayoral primary election in 2023. They also faced charges related to the city's 2019 election. Castillo faces more than 30 counts of illegally possessing absentee ballots. He was offered less than 3 years in prison, but declined. Now he could end up with a 165-year-long sentence. Jeter-Pataki, the woman who was caught on camera allegedly bringing handfuls of ballots to the absentee box, faces more than 100 counts of ballot and voting fraud. She was offered 3 years in prison. Instead, she'll go to trial, where she could theoretically be sentenced to 500 years. Years behind bars. Molly Ingram, WSHU News.
Coming up, a new exhibit at Yale explores the life and legacy of Rachel Carson. Stay here.
Buying a new car? Donate your old one to WSHU. It's fast, free, and supports the programming you love. Towing's on us. Just go to WSHU.org to get started. Thank you.
Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman has announced he will comply with a new state law that took effect yesterday that bans local police from helping ICE deport people over civil violations. This announcement comes one day after State Attorney General Letitia James issued subpoenas to Nassau County's police and sheriff's departments over their failure to end ICE cooperation agreements. Blakeman says he can't pick and choose which laws to enforce, but believes the ban will make Nassau more dangerous. Governor Hochul says the new law does not stop local police from cooperating on criminal matters involving undocumented immigrants. the Connecticut Department of Children and Families overpaid providers by more than $1.2 million in July, according to state auditors. The department reportedly duplicated payments for 141 providers. Auditors say thousands of people also had their personal information exposed due to a data breach in the department. Country music queen and just all-around American icon Dolly Parton has passed away. Back in the 90s, she launched a philanthropic program that provides kids with free books, and at least two Long Island communities took part in that, the Cutchogue New Suffolk Library and the Wyandanch School District. Parton had said the program was inspired by her father, who never learned to read. Region is defined by our waters, and no one captured that love for life by the shore better than the iconic conservationist Rachel Carson. She said, "If there is poetry in my book about the sea, it's not because I deliberately put it there, but because no one could truthfully write about the sea and leave out poetry." That's after she won the National Book Award for The Sea Around Us from 1951. An exhibit at Yale's Beinecke Library offers a glimpse at Carson's life beyond what was in your school textbook through handwritten manuscripts, letters, photos, and more. I stopped by to check it out. Of course, Carson's best-known work is 1962's Silent Spring. It was a total game-changer. It exposed the devastating effects of pesticides, launched the modern environmental movement, and led to the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency.
She was very much for citizen action, and for the individual sort of making a difference in whatever way they could. And she certainly did that in her own work and in her own life.
That's Carla Baritz. She co-creates the exhibit with James Kezanides. Both are librarians with Yale's Library of Area Studies and Humanities.
One of the things that we do working with material objects and with text is to try to get closer to that kind of that understanding of Carson, not just as a kind of popular figure, but through her work and through her own words.
Yeah. I like what you're saying about, okay, you learn about her in elementary school, but then that's kind of where it drops off, right? She's a person in a textbook, but when you have her writings and whatever all in front of you, it kind of like brings it to light, any historical figure, right?
And the personal writings are varied in their format. So you'll find, in addition to examples of her published writing.
That's James.
You'll find that in terms of the manuscript material, we'll have things ranging from notebooks where you see her jottings in doing her research, to a lot of correspondence and her style and tone and interest that come through in her letters with a variety of correspondence. She was a big letter writer, to her early drafts in manuscript form, whether handwritten or typewritten drafts of the books that ended up getting published. So I think all of these help shed light both on her thinking in terms of the subject matter, on her style as a writer, and also on just how she was a great writer.
Can we take a look?
Yeah.
Yeah, awesome. Okay.
The idea of wonder starts off the exhibit and carries throughout. That sense of curiosity about the natural world that, for many people, begins in childhood. And Carson captured that in one of her later works, A Sense of Wonder, published after she passed away from cancer in 1964.
And it's essentially, in the essay form, it was an essay that she wrote about her nephew Roger Carson, how she had essentially walked with Roger in Maine, where she had a cottage, every summer out on the shore, and taught him about the natural world. And it is very much a work that kind of champions that idea of paying close attention to the small things, and to one's local landscape, and to what one encounters on one's walks, and then using that as a kind of springboard for bigger picture thinking about engaging with the environment, doing environmental advocacy, being a person who as an adult is informed about the natural world and can advocate on its behalf and protect it.
Exactly. That's usually where it starts, right? The more time you spend outside, the more inclined you are to care about it.
And she was very much, she was formally trained. She had a bachelor's degree in biology. She had an MA in zoology from John Hopkins. But I think much of her work comes out of this impulse of simply being observant in being in the natural world herself, beyond kind of this kind of more academic and formal training.
In the 1930s, Carson began work on what's known today as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
That agency is itself aware of what the U.S. government is using in the 1940s and through the Second World War in terms of various, various tools in its toolkit, one of which becomes DDT, which is discovered to have insecticidal properties during the Second World War. It's used by the U.S. military. But of course, those working on the wildlife side in the U.S. government are beginning already then to get concerned about what effect this will have on the environment. Mm-hmm. So she even pitches to Reader's Digest in the mid-1940s an article on DDT. They turn it down.
The success of her book, The Sea Around Us, let her leave her job with the government, garner some fame, buy that cottage in Maine, and become a full-time writer. By the 1950s, she returned to her concerns about DDT. She drew on contacts with the Audubon Society and wildlife community to investigate things like declining raptor numbers in Pennsylvania and dying maple trees in Vermont. As her research grew, she knew Silent Spring was more than just an article.
The book is published in September of that year, but the summer, beginning in June of 1962, had published three important excerpts of it. So people already are seeing the content of the book in the summer of 1962 in the New Yorker.
James points to a display case.
This is the book, and this is, handwritten draft of chapter one of the book. When in fact, it was still a little different than what would ultimately become the very powerful opening chapter of Silent Spring. So again, just a kind of glimpse into the process of writing and the revisions and the different stages of the text.
Yeah. Those revisions produced a book that reached far beyond the scientific community. But as the curators point out, it's difficult to imagine anything having that kind of cultural impact today.
Personally, I'm not even sure if it's possible for any single book to move the culture or the conversation anymore. Mm-hmm. The emergence of the web, the emergence of social media. This was still a time and something that we tried to convey when a single magazine article or a single book could be a force, for a wide swath of people.
And I think one of the amazing things about Silent Spring is that people really read it. They read it cover to cover. Mm-hmm. And there were multiple print runs, and there was this kind of hunger for the message of Silent Spring in book form. And I don't know if that would be the case today. I think there's certainly that hunger for that message, but I don't know if people have the attention spans or the sort of... or if they are used to sort of reading an argument through in that way.
You can check out the exhibit through October 4th at Yale's Beinecke Library. Sabrina Garone, WSHU News. For the latest from around Long Island Sound, listen on the radio, online, with our free app, and tune in right here to the After All Things podcast every weekday evening. And for more from us, check us out over on Instagram. We are at WSHU Public Radio. I'm Sabrina Garone. Have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk tomorrow.